History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we want to hear. We do not want them to go untold, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do that, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Auburn, California, with a Navy veteran of World War II who's got a pretty unique story. Frank Ormerod, 93 years old. Not originally from California, and I think when people hear you speak, they're going to realize that you're from another part of the country. Tell me where you grew up, Frank.
Fall River, Massachusetts.
What was that like in the 20s and 30s, growing up with a brother and a couple sisters?
Well, it was kind of rough. Yeah. A lot of people was on welfare, but my father had a job. He soaked cloth and caustic in that, keep it from shrinking. Anyways, he had what they call a steady job. But he only earned 20 bucks a week. But anyways, he took care of us, and we all got along good. We didn't go starving. My mother was a very, very good cook, and she could make food that tasted good. My father, he was a carpenter. He built the house that we lived in Westport. He was an all-handyman, you know. And I worked with my father. My brother didn't want to work with my father, but I worked with my father all the time. Whatever he did, I was. And in a way, that's how I learned to be a mechanic, through my father. And when I got older, I worked in the garage. Larry Souza owned the garage, but this other guy was a mechanic with him, and I was good friends with him, and we would work together. I worked for nothing. When I was 14 years old, I'd go and work and work and work. I thought about being a mechanic, so I went to a Cadillac and Oldsmobile dealer, and the war was on, and they had a lot of new cars stored. Anyways, I worked on all kinds of cars. Well, I went to him, and I told him I need a job. Did he need any mechanics? And, of course, I'm 16 years old. He says, yeah, you know where we can get them? I said, yeah. I'm a mechanic. He says, what do you mean you're a mechanic? You're only 16 years old. I says, well, I worked for other garages and learned on other cars. He says, well, come back tomorrow and I'll try you out. So I was a kid. I had a 36 Chevrolet. I got money for gas. So I didn't go back for 2 weeks. I went back to him, and I says, is that offer still good? He says, yeah. He says, I got this Oldsmobile, six-cylinder. I want you to put a clutch in it. I said, okay. So anyways, he told me what to get and put in it, and they gave me the work order. And I went, and I got the stuff, and I tore the engine and the clutch out and put the new stuff in, new clutch, adjusted it, put it on the floor. And he's walking around in the shop, and he comes back, and he sees the cars on the floor. He says, thought you told me you was a mechanic. I says, yeah, I am. He says, when you gonna get started? I says, I'm all done. He says, you can't be all done. He says, so I gave him the work order. He looked on it. He seen all the stuff was there. He said, okay, you got a job. So anyways, I went to work for Cadillac and Oldsmobile, and I worked for him about 8 months. One day he came to me and he says, I know you worked on this car. Did you take a B book? I says, no, I didn't take no B book. And he says, well, you didn't take the B book? I says, no, I didn't. I says, I got gas books. I got an R book for tractors at home. I lived in the country. You don't believe me? I asked him, you don't believe me? He says, no, I don't believe you. I says, well, Bob, I don't want to work for you anymore. I went down to the Pontiac people, and they didn't even have a mechanic. I worked for them, and I told them, I want to go in the Navy, so I'm going to quit. He said, oh, don't quit. we'll get you a deferment. I said, no, no, I don't want no deferment. I want to go in the Navy while I make my choice, not while the state government makes my choice. It puts me on the Army. I don't want to be a ground pounder.
So you wanted to enlist in the Navy before they drafted you into the Army?
Yeah. So I enlisted in the Navy when I was 17. My mother signed for me to go in. I went to Sampson, New York. When I graduated from that, they put me on a shipment, went to New York City, Pier 92. And was that a hole? The captain's wife was more in command than he was. After the war was over, they prosecuted that captain for that. New Year's Eve, I went aboard the U.S. Argonaut, DD-617. I was on the ship. Of course, they're all lights out on the ship, you know, docking ship. Me being a new guy, I don't know my way around, and they called for me to go to number one gun. But I didn't know they wanted me to go to the upper handling room. But they wanted me to go to the lower handling room. I said, wow. He put me down there with two guys. One guy had ammunition shells, and they had a little hole. They passed the projectiles through the hole and then put it in the elevator and run it up the upper handle down of this deck, gun number one. Anyways, I knew why they call them tin cans. You could hear the water going by the ship. It sounded like it was in a tin can. But anyways, I was on that, and they told us if a shell, the projectile, if it's damaged in any way, get rid of it right away, because you never know it's going to blow up. So I think we was over in Hitley, bombarding 88 guns. We went over there with three cruisers. There was the Dido, that's a British cruiser, the Brooklyn, and the Philadelphia. And I'll tell you a story about that one. They said cease fire. When you got to cease fire, you got to unload the gun and put the shell in the elevator or hold it. So this guy had a shell in the breech, holding one shell in his hand, and when they said clear the breech, he took the one he had in his hand and he threw it in the elevator, which it was the open elevator, and it was way down on the bottom of the deck down there, and that shell fell right by my feet. And I grabbed that shell because they told us to get rid of it right away. I was in Went through the chief's quarters, opened the hatch, went through the chief's quarters. There's a ladder, but it had a big hatch. They didn't open that on the way. They had a little hatch that you went through. So holding the shell, opened that hatch, got out, and threw the shell overboard. And when I threw that shell overboard, I started shaking like mad. Because I could have blown up and didn't know it, you know? I was scared. But anyways, I love the Navy. I love my country.
Well, and I want to ask you, too, because everybody seems to remember something. You said that when you're working at the dealership, the war was already on. But what about that day when everybody found out the war was on? Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Well, I was a young kid then, you know. But I remember it. Yes, I'm bombing the Pearl Harbor.
So on the Ordronox, what was that like being a teenager with all these other guys on this destroyer? And I'm sure you didn't really know what you guys were in for, right?
No, I didn't. But they were my age, too. You know, a lot of them were my age. But there was older ones. But we had a good captain. He was a good captain, but he was an awful drunk.
Well, and you mentioned that you guys bombarded Italy.
We was bombarding between Anzio and Naples. See, the Fifth Army had moved up and taken Anzio, and they had to have support for it because the Germans were going to push them out. The Germans was not too far away. They was in Rome, and they were pushing up. And that 88 gun they had was a mean sucker. It was really bombing them. So we went up. We would go up there with our destroyer and another destroyer, and we would go with a cruiser. And the first cruiser we went up with was a British cruiser, the Dido. They go into this bay, they drop the hook, and when they drop the hook, they put the ball up. That's to tell other ships that the anchor's down. Anyways, Your captain called over to our captain and said, would you like a target? We'll have a observer plane pick a target out. And they didn't use little Piper Cubs like we did. They used Spitfires. The captain got the message for a target, and I was a lookout up near the director. You know where the gun director is at the top? Well, anyways, we fired a shell to get range and bearing of the target, and the Germans fired back at us. And boy, I'm telling you, that's how to get your location. Try to one shell. And then they say, commence firing. You go. That comes in. So anyways, kept seeing that. Boom. We got on the way right away. And we went up there a couple times. The Philadelphia went up there, hitting targets out. And it was night, and the Germans had E-boats. And they said, oh, there's an E-boat out there. The captain says, oh, well, we'll just ram it. But it was his own escort. It was the U.S. ZD-613 lob. And she cut it right in the engine room. Killed quite a few guys in the engine room. But it didn't cut the ship in half because the shafts are so big. But anyways, we took the Philadelphia down to Malta because they had a Navy Yard down there. And that's where Franklin Roosevelt came in on a cruiser. And he had a big raised deck, you know, and had a hill on it for the wheelchair to go on. I seen that over there. We didn't see the president, but that was one time we were there. But we went all over the Mediterranean.
Well, and even, I guess it would be before you did all that, you had already come up close and personal with some Germans a lot closer to where you grew up, just off the East Coast.
Yes. Well, we sunk a German submarine. Well, I was down in the engine room, so I came up there, and when I seen those Germans floating in that water, my heart went out to them. I felt sorry for them. But we had guys on there, they were wicked. They said, shoot the sons of guns, kill them. But anyways, we picked up the captain and 17 of his men on our ship.
Yeah, and I want to get that whole story. So this is 75 years ago now. This was April of 1944. And I think today, I mean, most of us alive today weren't even alive in World War II. And what we know of World War II, we hear about the Pacific. We hear about D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge. Maybe we hear a little bit about North Africa. We certainly hear about Pearl Harbor. But I think a lot of people today don't realize how many American ships were sunk in the Atlantic and how severe that German submarine threat was. So tell me where you guys were and how you discovered there was a German submarine there.
Well, we go on convoy duty over to Europe and we come back and then we'd be assigned to go to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Our Boston home port was Boston, but we never went there. We always went to the Brooklyn Navy Yard because it was a good Liberty town. And you know, guys get off a ship and that, they want to go someplace that's good, you know. So New York was a great town, and we had a lot of fun there. But anyways, we would go up to Casco Bay. There we go up for gunnery practice and all kinds of military things, and they came in order, submarine out there. Our squadron went out there. It's four destroyers, the 600, the Champlain, then there was the 601, the Neal, and then there was the 616, and then there was our ship, the Audronaux, DD-617.
And we'll hear about what exactly those destroyers encountered when we come back. 93-year-old Frank Ormerod of Auburn, California is our guest today. You can pull up some photos of him then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we come back, what happened with that German sub? Its 28 survivors included the captain, whose path would cross again with some of the Audronaux sailors decades later. It's quite a story, and you'll hear it from Frank Ormerod when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.